A very big welcome to this event, to Asicron. My name is Vasilis Panagiotis. I'm the director of the LSE Research Unit on Southeast Europe. We're hosting this event today together with the Anglo-Albanian Association, and thank you to Mr. Steve Nass and colleagues at the association for this collaboration. We've spent too much time doing online events and not being able to meet in person, so it's good to be back with our normal events, even though sometimes I get distracted by technological problems. So our speaker today is Dr. Dimitra Gitsa. Dimitra is a cultural practitioner and interdisciplinary scholar working on the intersection of memory studies, contemporary art and exhibition practices, and the post-socialist visual cultures. She's currently Alexander Nass Research Fellow in Albanian Studies at CES, the School for Slavonic and History and East European Studies at the University College London. And before joining UCL, she held academic positions at Goldsmiths as well as at Goldsmiths, and she completed her PhD in visual cultures at the University of Hertfordshire. Her work is also outside. At Goldsmiths, okay, yes. You see, my notes are, or my eyes are not translated. Apologies for that. So also work outside academia, of course. He has collaborated with numerous non-for-profit art and cultural organizations, including the British Council in Athens and the Institute of Contemporary Arts here in London. Let me say also a word or two about the Anglo-Albanian Association. It was founded in 1912, so I'm waiting for my notes, but I hope I'm excused. Has been at the heart of Albanian life in the UK for over 100 years. The association holds regular talks on Albanian history, culture and music, book launches and screenings of Albanian films, and also provides information to members on a range of Albania-related events and developments, including an e-newsletter, the Gazette, which is currently published 3 times a year and contains a wide range of articles about all aspects of Albanian life and culture. LSE has a bit of a tradition on work on Albania. We have a number of colleagues working on Albania, and obviously the Research Unit of Southeast Europe, LSE, also does work across Southeast Europe and in particular focus on the Western Balkans. So let me use the opportunity also to pre-announce 2 events, of which we do not know if they're going to happen because of the strikes currently taking place. But if everything goes well, we have 2 events in March, one on Montenegro, and then hopefully on the 28th of March, we're hosting the governor of the Bank of Albania here. You're all most welcome to attend his public lecture, 6 o'clock on the 28th of March. We have a collaboration with the Bank of Albania and doing some work, including a conference in Tirana, hence the story that Bernard was saying earlier. Okay, the event thankfully is now being recorded, so please be sensitive to that. If you're tweeting, the hashtag for today's event is #LSEAlbania, one word. The recording will be made available as a podcast subsequently, subject to continuing not having technical issues. I will pass the floor to our speaker who will present on the topic, which I didn't announce, the legacy of post-industrialism in Albania. But then please reserve any questions, comments, and the discussion that we can have for afterwards for the Q&A session. So with these introductory remarks, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us for this talk. Of course, thank you to the Anglo-Albanian Association for making this happen, and especially to Stephen Nash for pushing so that we're here today. And of course, a big thank you to the LSE Research Center on Southeast Europe for hosting us. So the talk today will be about the legacies of post-industrialism in Albania. And I have loosely structured the presentation in 3 key areas. I will start by providing the context and some theoretical concerns that appear when we engage with post-industrial landscapes, as well as post-industrial societies, and in particular in Albania. The second part, I'll discuss some case studies And of course, because I'm a cultural theorist and an art historian, I'm going to use contemporary art practices to build a thread into this journey across ruined factories in Albania. And to conclude, I will pose a question of what is to be done with these vast abandoned factories in Albania, which hopefully will also give us material to continue the conversation. So I will start with a personal story. I was born in Albania, and my parents immigrated to Greece in the early 90s. In the first years of my life, I grew up with my grandparents. And when I joined my parents in Athens, I was always curious about how their lives used to be in Albania. And I would always ask, but obviously, perhaps the logical outcome when it comes in the aftermath of immigration, which is also followed by perhaps trauma or nostalgia, I wasn't quite able to make a thread and a narrative of what life used to be. So one of my most vivid memory of growing up would be the family road trips that we would do to visit my grandparents. And what made those memories even more intense was every time we would pass through the abandoned industrial complexes, and more specifically, the abandoned metallurgical complex in Elbasan, where I was born and where my grandparents used to live. And every time we would pass through that ruined complex, something astonishing would happen. My father would start narrating about the time he used to work at that factory. Even in the ruins, he was able to allocate the functions of each buildings, and he would start remembering names of his friends who would work together, who apparently he had lost contact with because they had all immigrated. And although those stories were not really mine, it was my father's, somehow they were also connected with my own experience of a second generation Albanian in Greece. So somehow I discovered in this giant industrial ruined something that came to offer a tangible explanation to all those difficult memories of displacements. It was the flow of history itself shaping and affecting lives. So before I start on analyzing, I would like to make a disclaimer here about how I approach those sites. The first is that although I'm speaking about industrial ruins, and I know that to some people maybe the word ruins might bring negative connotations, I approach those ruins as sites of memory. And I use here the term as it was used by Pierre Morel. I don't have here the quote, so I'll have to go over here to read this. He says in this text here, contrary to historical objects, the sites of memory have no referent in reality, or rather, they are their own referent, pure, exclusively self-referential signs. This is not to say that they are without content, physical presence, or history. It is to suggest that what makes them sites of memory is precisely that by which they escape from history. In this sense, the sites of memory is double, a site of excess closed upon itself, concentrated in its own name, but also forever open to the full range of its possible significations. Right, so sites of memory does not necessarily mean sites of history, because sites of memory, on the one hand, they are official memorials, monuments, but also sites of memory can be the abandoned industrial ruins. And it's exactly these new possibilities that are inscribed in those spaces that have offered perhaps a space for contemporary artists coming from a different generation, right? So the generation of post-memory, as Marianne Hirsch would say, a generation of people who might not have actual memories of the communist past, but they see that communist past in the everyday life through the material remnants. And the second element is that I approach those sites as sites of difficult knowledge. And it's exactly this engagement with them that can offer perhaps spaces for different knowledge production. And I use the term difficult knowledge, as was introduced by Erica Lehr, where they make a distinction between the so-called lovely knowledge, which is a knowledge that already reassures and perhaps it's already familiar. But then on the other hand, a difficult knowledge, as they say here, challenges the way we perhaps know, the way we approach history, for instance. And it's exactly difficult because perhaps it also invites us to unlearn, not just learning, but also to unlearn what the ways we have learned perhaps history or certain political realities. And then there is the question of why bother with industrial buildings? Why bother with spaces that have been around for perhaps in Albania the past more than three decades? The first element here is that industrial ruination supports differentiated orientations toward time and space, and it marks a disruption in memory practices through an uncertain relationship between past and present, which receives tangible form, and it is reflected in the deconstructed and derelict material space. This is also a disruption of existing discourses and alternative knowledge on reading the past and its different histories. Their very state of ruination becomes an entry point to negotiate a particular social and political reality which led to the ruination in the first place. So factors in ruination become an active mode for negotiating the process of decay, as well as its political, social, economic, and cultural outlets. Here, abandonment is clearly not something that occurred in a specific temporal framework, but rather is a continuous process, a ruin always in the making. The second reason that we need to care about those industrial sites is that in the Western societies, industrialization has been understood as a root of modernity. Similarly, post-industrialism signals the transition to post-40s production, which is characterized by the dominance of global market, the shift from manual labor to the service sector, the disrupted linear relation between employer and employee, and an ever-increasing precarity. Again, although I'm talking about Albania, we can argue here that this reality is perhaps common to all societies that have experienced perhaps an abrupt transition to the post-industrial phase. Post-industrialism in Eastern Europe, though, has additional peculiarities because of its intertwining with the socialist past. In this case, factories were not owned by private capital entities competing on an open market. They belonged to the state, and in principle, they existed for the whole society and not just the profit of an individual factory owner. Similarly, the destruction of those factories in the post-socialist phase did not occur because of financial crisis. The collapse of the socialist regime also meant the collapse of the state, its ideology, its social institution, and its fair system of understanding life and work. Examining post-industrial decay and post-socialism, Anne Kapuska notes that the ruination of former factories in the former East frees them, and I use a quote here, frees them of the utopian communist rhetoric embedded in them, but at the same time also burdens them with new questions about the possibility of creating non-utopian spaces, reflections, representations, and of course, in the present. A third reason which we can't ignore, and it appears when we engage with industrial ruins, is that in many cases, even in the state of abandonment, former industrial complexes keep producing unregulated waste. Or the previously emission of dangerous pollutants remain in the soil and in the air. It occurs then that the ecosystem itself bears its own memory. We might ignore to engage with that past, but the nature itself becomes an archive that remembers. So in that sense, caring for a past means also to care for a future. And here exactly like acknowledging the ecosystem around post-industrial areas, it means that we have to deal with the concept of deep time, so time that perhaps goes beyond the human life. And of course, a fourth factor is that the closures, destructions, and privatizations of these industrial plants resulted in an alteration of social, cultural, and economic fabric of these cities, as well as the relationships and interactions that bonded together its local communities. At the same time, in many occasions, the closure of the factory brings economic instability, unemployment, poverty, and migration, leading to emptiness of towns and villages whose existence could only be justified in relation to the operations of the factory. More interestingly, exactly because of the vital role that these industrial sites played in constructing the urban fabric, the process of ruination also affected and shaped the ways in which local communities perceive, interpret, and relate with their past. As Alisma has written here, legacies of industrial ruination and urban decline are embodied in local people's experiences, perceptions, and understanding, and emerge in unexpected, indirect, or diffuse forms as uncertainty, as ambivalence, as nostalgia, as trauma, as endurance, as imagined futures. I'm borrowing the term legacies, as you saw in the title of the presentation today, exactly to highlight that in a way the industrial past and the material remnants of those past are in a way an unwanted heritage. And a heritage that perhaps a different generation, a younger generation, has to deal with. So it's not something that existed in a particular time or space, but it's something that keeps on going, right? So obviously we can see across the world many examples where former industrial sites have been reused, regenerated, repurposed. More recently, we saw the opening of the Battersea Power Station, who has turned, I think it's without no surprise to see another perhaps shopping mall. Then there is a tendency as well to transform them into museums of contemporary arts, as is the museum in Athens, but also Tate, again using art as a form to generate perhaps capital. Then we have examples where they are turned into museums of the industrial history, and of course, as is the case of the industrial art biennial in Croatia, where they use an art event in order to bring life back to those post-industrial societies. But in addition to those things that are in sites that in capital that perhaps are easier to be reused, in rural areas, industrial ruins are basically neglected. And now we move on to Albania, which is a very particular, I would say, example. And it adds another layer of why it is important to deal with that. The researcher Artan Hoxha, in his paper that was published in 2021, he did an extensive research on the sugar factory in Malik, which is in southern Albania, just a little bit outside Korça. And in this paper from 2021, he argues that industrialization in Albania was a first modernity in the sense that it was associated with the socialist utopia and ideology, and the post-industrial ruins of that former factory represents a second modernity in the sense that it is associated with the utopia of Europe and belonging to the West. In analyzing here how Maliki was essentially turned from a swamp into a sugar factory that basically changed the lives of local communities, he writes that Maliki's refinery ruins demonstrate how, to recall Henri Lefebvre, the contradiction between the flows and fixed cities has been solved in favor of the former. Those ruins document Albanians' leap into a new age that Ulrich Beck has coined as second modernity and risk society. While the LSP's regime used the combine as a means for transforming society and building a socialist utopia, the road to the new European utopia struck the old securities to the heart. The factory symbolizes security of livelihood and social order. With its disappearance, no other mechanism has replaced it. The people living there contemplate the end of the age that created them and realize that their fate is taking a direction they cannot control. So again, we see here a reference to how the closure of factories affect the livelihoods of people. He has written extensively about this case study in his book that is coming out this month. And he argues in the book that the industrial transformation of Malik demonstrates actually that even despite, even amid the dictatorship, workers and people who were involved in the sugar project were not simply passive receivers of models from the nation's capital. The second element is that the history of industrialization in Albania challenges predominantly mainly Western stereotypes of cultural, political, and economic backwardness that see Albania as being under or semi-developed, old-fashioned. So the history of industrialization demonstrates that Albania, in fact, experienced its own modernity and obviously its own post-industrialism. The peculiar thing here is that everything happened very quickly. So after the Second World War, Albania was a semi-feudal country defined by its social conservatism and outdated means of production. Adapting the Soviet model, the Communist Party set out a series of five-year plans to industrialize Albania. The first and second plans focused on the agricultural sector. The third plan on the development of small handcrafts factories. And the fourth plan, between 1966 and 1970, inaugurated a period of intense industrialization with large industrial complexes built on the outskirts of major cities. For instance, a nitrogen fertilizer factory in Fier, a rubber factory in Durrës, a textile factory in Berat, a hydroelectric plant in Shkodër, and a chrome mining in Burqiz are some of the countless factories built at this short time. New towns were also created from scratch to accommodate factory workers. For instance, Poliçan, a town which is almost like ruin nowadays, was constructed in the 60s simultaneously with the establishment of the armory factory. With Albania being ethnically and religiously diverse, industrialization was a strategy to transform the peasant communities into a homogenized working class. Population started moving into the new industrial urban centers where they lived, learned, and worked together. In the late 50s, more than half of Albanian population was illiterate. So the new skills that were needed both in constructing and later in operating the factories led many people into formal education. Women especially benefited from this process. the party's plan for women's emancipation was a strategy to compensate for labor shortages, but at the same time, it shifted the norms of a traditional and patriarchal society. By the 80s, nearly one half of the country's students in universities were women. In the industrial sector, women comprised 43.5% of the overall workforce. So industrialization, obviously, in Albania was connected also to the party's plan to make the country self-sufficient and autonomous. Having broken ties with Yugoslavia as early as 1948 and with the Soviet Union in 1961, Albania was financially dependent for a while on China to fund major industrial developments for a short period. An example of that is also the metallurgical factory in Elbasan. It's interesting how Hoxha had stated at that point that industrialization was a program completely realizable, although we can argue whether that was the case or not, especially when that was kind of a reality lived for only a short time. Because indeed, Albania reached its industrialization peak in an astonishingly short time. However, this progress came at great cost, and without the aid of stronger allies, the industrial plants became practically unsustainable. The extreme isolation destroyed the country's economy, and at the same time, it had exhausted Albanian citizens, who at that point were craving basic individual freedoms that were essentially forbidden and non-existent. The collapse of the state socialism brought also the decline of industrialism in Albania. In a way, the slogan at that time, let's destroy the old, it was also a slogan that reflects the attitude towards the industrial sector and the wider infrastructure built during the socialist regime. State-owned non-operating factories were abandoned, and the few privatized operating factories continued production with a significantly reduced workforce, unfair working conditions, and unregulated emissions of dangerous pollutants. The metallurgical complex was the peak of this industrialization and the most perhaps prestigious project. It was called at that time Albania's Pride and Joy, or the steel of the party, exactly because it used to produce steel. And it was the country's largest industrial site and the first steel plant. The metallurgical complex was constructed on the outskirts of Elbasan, a city at the center of Albania, 50 kilometers from the capital. Elbasan had a symbolic value, having been an important crossroads for commerce since Roman antiquity. The erection of the steel plant changed the urban landscape, making Elbasan a central, but also the most polluted city in Albania. With 520 buildings, a transport network system that was connected to the national railway, cable car and streets, the metallurgical complex was approximately half the size of Elbasan at that time. So it was like a city within a city. Various professional schools opened to train a new generation of workers specializing in metallurgy. And by 1989, the metallurgical complex employed 12,000 workers. The closure of the metallurgical complex brought also the decline of Elbasan. In the 90s, some factories and facilities were privatized by foreign companies, which took up the opportunity of a cheap workforce, abundant natural resources, and pre-existing industrial structures. These companies significantly reduced the number of factories, workers, and their respective salaries, whilst producing excessive and unregulated industrial waste. And at the same time, privatizations brought unemployment, instability, and immigration. Informal Mind was the first exhibition that engaged with the ruins of the industrial past in 2014. And it included both pre-existing artworks. For instance, the video piece Answer Me by Anri Sala. Maybe some of you might have encountered him in various exhibitions, which shows a woman struggling to communicate. And Answer Me is a study on the aesthetics of moving image, time, the politics of modern life, and other artworks, including Sadiq Spahis' Under Pressure, which was a huge bust of the Italian politician Silvio Berlusconi, which the Albanian artist uses as a parody to speak about corruption in contemporary politics. Also, the exhibition included performance piece by Serbian artist Marina Markovic and Boris Ribar, which dealt with the human right to asylum. All the participating artists were invited to choose a specific space within the abandoned industrial plant to exhibit their work. Other artworks that were part of the exhibition was a site-specific performance, Sustainable Privatization, by the Montenegrin artist Milena Jovistrovic, during which she made a performance where she was selling bricks to the visitors. The artist conceived the performance when, during her fieldwork at the industrial area, she saw local people gathering and selling bricks that they had previously taken from the industrial plant. While the artist was selling during her performance the bricks, in the background, she had assistants who were extracting the last remaining bricks, exactly to show in a way the labor that was taking place. And she says in reference to this performance, I'm quoting here, "It's a perfect illustration of our relations to the past. We can destroy and steal everything that is state property from the past without any responsibility, and state can also destroy anything from the past without any responsibility. Is our existence nowadays all about stealing and cheating?" So the above statement highlights both how the state has neglected former industrial places, as well as the fact that private companies have taken away what once belonged to the communities. So more than aesthetic metaphor, the bricks as the material remnants of the old factory enable the performance to become a reenactment of privatization, inviting visitors to see the stages of the commodification process. Private companies co-opt what once belonged to the state and then sell what were once public goods under new vocabularies of development and sustainability. Another art engagement with an abandoned factory that I would like to present here today is the case of the textile factory, the former textile factory in Tirana. The history of the textile factory is connected to the history of women's emancipation in Albania. When the factory started operating in 1949, a textile school in the same area was inaugurated. The garment industry was traditionally considered to offer suitable work for women. Young girls and women moved across Albania to receive training with the promise of employment at the textile factory. For this reason, Combinat was known as the women's neighborhood. While during the state socialism, Tirana was inhabited by the intellectuals, and internal immigration was strictly regulated and forbidden, meaning that people from the countryside could not move to the capital, Combinat became the first working class neighborhood close to the capital. Workers were trained together and shared the same living apartments. The industrial complex included also like a community library, cultural events such as theater and music performances were organized in the factory's courtyard. So inaugurated in 1949, the textile factory had a particular significance in for Tirana. This neighborhood, which is called Combinat exactly because the factory used to be there, was at that time was not a neighborhood of Tirana, but an autonomous satellite town separated from the capital by agricultural fields. this new residential area was inhabited by people employed at the factory. By the 1950s, the neighborhood consisted of 30,000 residents and included the facilities of a typical urban settlement: hospitals, schools, kindergarten, and police station. As Tirana expanded after socialism, Combinat grew into an integral neighborhood in the capital, with its name being the only reminder that this area was once an industrial center. The exterior facade, which remains from the former factory, bears visible signs of decay. And despite the many small shops, kiosks, unofficial second-hand markets, and private businesses now attached to the structure of the original building. The size and numbers of public spaces which once surrounded the factory have reduced. And although factory workers as a group no longer occupy this area, the neighborhood is still inhabited by people living in precarious conditions and working in unstable jobs. In March 2005, contemporary Albanian artist Anisa Chanaliaj stood on top of a tall empty pedestal in front of the former textile factory, towering her body over the passersby who had gathered around the unusual spectacle. The artist was dressed in a worker's uniform, while her whole body was covered in a white paint, resembling a socialist statue worker. A nearby banner showed the title of the performance piece, "Welcome, Dear Workers." Throughout the 40-minute performance, the artist stood still, keeping her eyes closed. Although she remained still, her body was tilted forward in the suggestion of emotion. During the socialist regime, the same pedestal had the statue of Stalin. So it was still a remnant of Albania's ties with the Soviet Union. Explaining the motive behind the performance, the artist has written, "I believe that the workers of the socialist times are in essence the same workers that we see today, except that in those days the conditions were the same for everyone, and today the working conditions are much worse. My placing the worker on a pedestal had nothing to do with the role played by statues in the time of the dictatorship. Rather, it emphasizes the fact that this class, meaning the working class, still exists. Not just that they exist, but they must insist on the rights that at minimum should belong to them. It's an attempt to say, people, listen, we exist and we deserve better." The performance grew out of the artist's observations of the changes that happened in the working class populations of Combinat neighborhood of Tirana after the collapse of the socialism dictatorship. The artist aimed to show with her performance that the working class, even if the factory is not there anymore, they still exist and they remain invisible because the contemporary conditions of labor, precarity, and exploitation have become more abstract and disparate under the current state of neoliberalism. It's interesting also to mention that in 2021, forced demolitions started taking place in Combinat after a blow, of course, the earthquake. But this happened despite local protests. The government's plan is to regenerate the area by constructing new private apartments over a surface of 1.5 million square meters. Now, of course, this progress is necessary in that sense. But at the same time, it also makes us question what is the saying here of the local communities and how that is changing their livelihoods. At the same time, it means that the last material remnants of Tirana's industrial past will disappear from the urban fabric. In terms of like the effect that textile factories have on women, again, this is not unique for Albania, but it's a commonality that exists in all the former East. Chiara Borchiogli, who has done a research on the ways in which the closure of textile factories has affected the labor of women. She writes here that post-socialist deindustrialization brought a general devaluation of industrial work in general and of women's industrial work in particular. Labor and welfare rights rapidly deteriorated, pushing working class women towards increasing dependence on informal work and on family networks. I would also like to briefly mention the work of Adrian Zanelli, who represented Albania at the Venice Biennial in 2019. Maybe The Cosmos Is Not So Extraordinary presents a video in which the industrial ruins were used as a platform to juxtapose the past with the future. The artwork was a continuation of Zanelli's previous video installation, which constructs a failed utopia of the socialist system with the unfulfilled desires and future dreams of the main protagonist. The video borrows its title from a sentence found in a science fiction novel, On the Way to Epsilon Eridani, by Albanian physicist and writer Arion Huysmans, written at I think I might have to skip some.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So the artist explains that the inspiration to create this artwork was a slag heap he had once found at the metallurgical complex of Elbasan when making the video Beneath the Surface, There Is Just Another Surface. He then consulted a geologist who explained that the slag consisted of chrome, a metal extracted from the mines of the mountains of Burgiza in northern Albania. The video follows a group of five teenagers as they wander the mines in this northern town that was once an industrial center of ferrochrome production. The artist explains that he met the group of teenagers during his research trip to the mine and decided to make them the protagonists of his video. In the video, the teenagers are dressed in workers' uniform and wear helmets with torches, looking like young miners. Although this might seem a fictional scene, child labor in Albania is still a social reality, with many children working in chromium mines. Actually, a UNICEF report from May 2022 estimated that up to 200 children are exploited in the energy sector, mostly in the mines of these sites. So for Zanelli, the industrial ruins become a metaphor to investigate the relationship between emancipation and failure, between the past and possible utopias, including both utopias of the past and potential utopic imaginaries of the present. So I mentioned earlier in the talk how ecosystem and nature carries their own memory. A remaining material that was still present at the metallurgical factory led Zanelli to actually go to Burgiz in the northern Albania. Perhaps similar to what Cenaglia tried to show with her performance at the Combinat in Tirana, the mining community of Burgiza demonstrates that despite Albania's post-industrial state, a working class that is still occupied in the industrial sector exists, only that their working conditions have worsened. For instance, in the past 8 years, in the remaining facilities that are still operating, more than 50 miners have lost their lives in the chrome mining exactly because they work without security and without proper equipment. At the same time, according to a research conducted in 2016 titled Features of Environmental Issues Related to Abandoned Mining Exploitation in Albania, demonstrated that the abandoned mines in this particular area are not are actually still contaminating vast territories, posing life-threatening danger to humans, other living and non-human lives, and also to the landscape in general. At the same time, the lack of perhaps current projects for dealing with this abandoned mining increases the harmful effects for longer term perspectives. So this highlights that the impact is not only regional, but it's also, it has consequences that tend to spread more widely. So in a way, what is to be done with this unwanted legacy? Or perhaps, what is to be done with a difficult heritage and that has been inherited from the past? A research titled Industrial Heritage in Albania, published in Industrial Archaeology Review in 2015, conducting a survey, discovered that 172 industrial sites, out of 172 industrial sites, 47% of them are still in good condition, 22% are at risk, 7% are at extreme risk, and 5% of the factories have completely vanished. So I would say that in addition to becoming these industrial sites, in addition to becoming an entry point to understand the changes that occurred in the post-socialist space, industrial ruins, since they are essentially abandoned both by local authorities but also by private entities, can become platforms used by local communities. For instance, Uzina was a space that was put together by a group of volunteers with the help of an NGO. And basically they reclaimed an abandoned tractor factory to create a social space for the youth. It's interesting here how they write that the idea of this social space is rooted in the idea of the commons. Rather than a resource, the commons is a process, a set of social relations by which a group of people shares a responsibility for a particular space. The city or the neighborhood should be seen as commons, a social system with a dedicated community that owns and manages the city or the neighborhood according to inclusive values. And they write here how this attempt is also associated to reclaiming, in a way, the right to the city. Now, this is part of another research that I'm doing, but I think it is valuable to consider those abandoned factories as commons in the sense that they belong to their communities. They are part of the urban fabric. At the same time, they are also a resource in the sense that they offer the space, but also resource can be included as immaterial entities such as memories, experiences, and knowledge. And going back to this space, I think it's important to realize how this abandoned factory it became, in a way, a space to cover the need for access to public and social spaces, and particularly in the time where Tirana is undergoing regeneration. And then there is a question of what happens to the spaces and who has access to those spaces. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm going to wrap up and end here. And I look forward to hearing your questions and comments, either now or maybe in a written form at my email. Thank you for your attention.
That was quite fascinating and quite a few issues, I think, one could unpack. I would like to open it up directly to your questions, comments, and we see how we guide the discussion. So please identify yourselves if you want to ask a question. Okay.
That was great fun, very interesting. As I said to you earlier, was recently in Albania, in certain places only. I like this idea of reclaiming the commons, which you ended up with. I mean, one of the places I landed in Tirana were not industrial ruins, but this was the old castle in the middle of the town. Now this had been reclaimed, it had been reclaimed and was full of sort of bourgeois and expensive restaurants. So that was the reclamation of a space which I was very conscious of. The other thing that I was thinking about, again, has nothing to do with industrial ruins, but has to do with other kinds of ruins which I was conscious of. And this was not only in Albania, but I saw this in Kosovo over the border as well. And this was churches. And the thing that I wanted to, which left an indelible memory for me, was a church in the middle of Pristina, which had been built just before Albania started to assert its, as Kosovo started to assert its independence, which had been built by the Serbian authorities as a kind of replica of Hagia Sophia, and it's left in the field now as an empty building, never properly finished, but is a space. And you walk past it and you cannot help but thinking of some kind of past, what kind of memories were associated with who was involved in this and what it then became. And that seemed to be an excellent place for reclamation, with a lot of the kind of imagery, the ideas of sort of losts, futures, pasts, the sort of the good and the bad nostalgia that you talked about. So I wonder whether you could expand upon this. Does it have to be only about industrial ruins, and does it have to be other kinds of ruins of the past?
Thank you for this very important question. In relation to the first part of the question, I think you're right. Like, this is a tendency that happens right now in Tirana, where maybe some people might argue that the regeneration that is happening is quite similar perhaps to what happened in Skopje in 2014, where it's like completely rebranding of the capital with the aim, of course, to belong to the European Union and make the city as the next European capital. But then it's exactly like at what cost, and who is to decide about that? A very significant moment of those was the demolition of the National Theatre, for instance, that happened amid a pandemic, meaning that, you know, there were more other important issues to care about at that time. And it happened despite an intense mobilization, and the community itself was using the building was against the demolition. And then there's the question of what will happen to that space. And of course there were plans to build an expensive, private building with apartments and shopping malls. As if, yeah, like we need more shopping malls. Then there is also the other building, the pyramid, which in the Civil War, if I can use this this term, in 1997, it became the landmark of protest. And again, there were like many debates and conversations about demolishing the building. But because it's in such a central public space where people still use it, either by climbing on it or by the youth just hanging around, so it's still like, despite it's basically like a ruined, almost like a ruined place, it's still like functional in that sense. Also, artists have used it to perform work, and I think there are like a foreign architectural company has been associated again to regenerate it, making it, I don't know, like a youth center or whatever. So there is a debate of how that transformation happens. And the second question as well, I completely agree that it's not just post-industrial ruins, but there are, again, like sites of memory that still exist, including churches, including perhaps like former statues or memorials that still bring perhaps complex and contested reactions, which exactly highlight for me memory battles, right? And how history is written, is rewritten, is interpreted. Now, Kosovo is a completely different story, I think. When I was in Pristina, actually, it's very interesting what you mentioned about the unfinished church. It's something that I also noticed, and the difference there is exactly like the war reality and a post-war society, but also the battles between the dominant powers over interpreting that history. Yeah, I don't know if this answers.
We can talk about this later, but I think this is fascinating. I would love to talk to you later.
Yes?
Yeah, thank you very much for the interesting talk. I really appreciated it also when you came at the end to the idea of the commoning, and you had the image of different people, and they all look relatively young. So can you tell us a bit more about who motivates these the claiming of the spaces, and then, how the commoning is happening, kind of what kind of political structure is behind it? Is it more like youth coming together, or is there also an incentive? So what kind of struggles are there?
Thank you for that question, because it gives me an opportunity to speak more about this other part of my research, which was also like part of my PhD, actually. In the case of Uzina, it was through the intervention of an NGO, and it was the same people that were also involved in another project in Pristina, actually, a space called Thermokis. And again, in that setting, they basically occupied a heating company or factory that was left semi-built exactly because of the war started in the 90s. And they work with volunteers. So we speak about volunteer labor in this setting, and people who are actually giving their free time to create spaces for gatherings, for coming together. They also organize public events without profit and without monetization. In the case of Tirana, and this is very interesting, is that they also explain in detail, like, you know, this kind of transparency. They explain in detail the process of putting together the space. And they also explain how, after the pandemic, basically they were struggling to maintain the space, right? Because it needs like simple duties like cleaning or paying for electricity. And they explain how they were completely unsupported from the local authority in sustaining that space. And I do believe that, you know, it's younger people, and inevitably it's younger people. And to me, as I mentioned in the beginning of the talk, the notion of a post-memory. So like a generation of people that are basically left to maybe like build life from the ruins. And with essentially being unable to access formal institutions, formal resources, the hierarchy as well, by reclaiming spaces that no one sees or no one cares about, is both a symptom of a problem and maybe also a solution, in the sense of like thinking of common heritage or governing sites of heritage that are more horizontal, more inclusive as well. And I think especially in the art sector in Albania, that would be quite useful, I think.
One question. John, I'm a
thank you for this. It's a really interesting talk. I mean, I think anybody who's, you know, who regularly visits Albania, you said about 170 sites next time, I think.
About?
Sorry? So there's about 170 sites. I would think there are thousands all over the country. And the ones that you've highlighted have been the ones that are sort of like close to towns. Elbasan is close to Tirana, you're talking about things actually in Tirana, like reclaiming this factory to Rosina. What do you do in the places which are not so close to big centres of population? Places that are not going to appeal to NGOs, external investors, whatever, to invest in these places. Bulgis, for example, there are all sorts of mines, you know, there's like a coal mine in Memadia right up in the hills, it's quite difficult to get to. So these sites, these commons, are littered all over the country. And I would have thought it's just not practicable to, you're basically going to have to kind of like make a hierarchy. You're going to have to decide that some are more worth saving than others on the basis of, I don't know what, accessibility, finance, whatever, but you know, you're going to have to make a decision. The other thing which I think is really interesting, which is sort of like a bit of a sidebar to this, is that anybody who, again, who's been to Albania will have seen these lapidars, these memorials all over the country, hundreds of them, again, probably thousands, commemorating moments of, mainly during the War of National Liberation. Not all, but most of them. And these are actually being really well kept up. And I think there was a move a few years ago as well to keep the martyr cemeteries in good shape. And, you know, the government put money in having them cleaned and, you know, having the statues rebuilt and all this kind of stuff. So, and I can understand how that works, because that is quite small, it's quite precise, you can keep the monument up, you've got a space that you can preserve. Basically, you're going to have to make decisions. I suppose that's my point. Some things are easy, like restoring a monument or a lapidar. Other things, I would have said, are almost impossible.
That's completely a valid point. I think that it's important maybe to acknowledge the historical element here. What is the effect of the closure of the factory? Especially for rural areas, because we speak about the emptying towns in Albania, but sometimes we forget to mention that, oh, they might have been industrial centers in the past. So of course, like sustaining or regenerating, I don't know when would be the right word to use here, because I'm always suspicious of regeneration. It's not possible to do it like across the country. But I do think that maybe the state of ruination and emptiness might highlight other areas of social and political lives. Like, for instance, by bringing different forms of employability, by thinking how to re-inhabit those spaces. Like I know, for instance, that my parents never immigrated with the idea that they will never return. And I think that many, many other immigrants and people who left, they had in their mind that maybe someday they will return. And I think that, speaking of younger people and the younger generation who are, keep leaving, I think that this generation maybe leaves without looking back. So I think not necessarily engaging with the sites per se, but rather with what used to be there and has gone, and engaging in a way with other resources that might still exist perhaps in the same community, like skills or knowledges or different like populations as well.
Yeah. Vesna?
Yes. Vesna Popovsky, LSE. I would like to ask you in relation to how you started your presentation, which is connected with Pierre Noir and his sites of memory. You were showing us quite a lot of sites, and I was just wondering how many memories, actually, I would say there is a plural of these to be used in this case to be able to understand all these different places. And have you done any research in relation to people's memories about the place, how they feel, therefore, that the places should be maybe used today? How do they relate, therefore, to their past, their present, and also future of these places?
Thank you. That's a very useful, also methodological question. I think when it comes to acknowledging memory, perhaps we can distinguish the official memory to the unofficial memories that are perhaps more effective, more difficult to become visible in the public space. And in this case, invisibility, it also means erasure from the public space. So I think by engaging with the industrial heritage, it means speaking about the memories of working class population. And it's interesting because even during the dictatorship, which was supposed to be an egalitarian society, there were still classes. There was a working class that was occupied in factories, there were people occupied in land, and of course there were also the very few who had managed to go to universities, or maybe they had intellectual background from their parents or grandparents. But then it means who writes the history, right? Like who writes the history of the working class people? Which is also like part of like in a way like acknowledging. So I think that part of my research, I'm more interested right now in the textile factories, particularly in Albania. In addition to the one in Tirana, there is also another textile factory in Berat, who is also abandoned. And a future step of this research is to conduct interviews with women, also men, but I think the majority were women who were employed there. And that will also give space to perhaps capture those type of memories.
First, I'd like to thank you, Dimitra, very much for this lecture, which we've been talking about for several months. Thank you, Director, for allowing the sort of bringing together of the LSE and the Anglo-Albanian Association, and I hope this this can continue. I'm glad that my colleague John here mentioned these extraordinary slogans, mainly slogans built in rocks and stones on mountainsides, because it seems to me that they also do add another sort of expression of what that era was like. The only trouble is about restoring them is that really one's restoring Enver Hoxha slogans, basically. I mean, it's Rufta Enver Hoxha or something of that sort that you find. That, but they are interesting and, you know, worth preserving, I think, in some form. And it was, we actually had a rather good film show in the Anglo-Albanian Association. We show films when we can, when we get home. And there was a very good one about these very outcrops of slogans at the top of hills or mountains. And one factor about them is very often they are very inaccessible, and you have to be quite nimble to get up and repair them or do whatever you have to do with them. I mean, it's like going up some other mountains in Albania, and you're going through rocks and scree, and then to your astonishment you find there's a small Bektashi temple right up at the top there with a priest sitting there. And you wonder how on earth that can happen. And I just finally I mentioned one other thing is that I noticed when I was in Tirana and taking a few photographs of street scenes that actually, when I was looking through my camera, I hadn't noticed that on one wall that was in my picture frame was actually, there was an old slogan, Love de Papa Show. That I think you can see in many parts of Albania. These old slogans which have nearly disappeared, but they're still just visible. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like in Strasbourg, if you look carefully, most of it's all in French, but there are some old German signs visible if you look carefully. Anyway, many thanks.
Yeah, that's a very interesting comment, because it shows exactly that regional areas are not in the spotlight, right? So we don't care about what happens in rural areas. But I just wanted to make a comment that by reclaiming this past, we don't mean by restoring perhaps a dictatorship. It was an oppressive dictatorship. I think the important thing is exactly to see that people, even in that structures, they were still able to have set control over their work and livelihoods, for instance. But yeah, like the slogans, it's very interesting because they're exactly like remnants of a very traumatic past and difficult past. And I think that exactly by ignoring it, it's not helpful or resourceful for the next generations. It means that it needs to be dealt with in that cases. And speaking of trauma as well and a difficult past, many theories, and I'm thinking here like with art historian Griselda Pollock, who writes that we can't understand trauma itself, but rather we understand the traces of it, right? So I think that by engaging with those traces, we can also understand the present.
John?
Yes, Dimitri, once again, thank you for a fascinating lecture. And there's so much cross history. And of course, we're talking about a post-industrial situation, which is fairly immediate, you know, at the end of the last century, the beginning of this one. Whereas we find comparisons all the way.
John, maybe you can speak up.
Oh, sorry, all the way back in history. You know, if you go to Avebury in Wiltshire, in the UK, what happened down there. But as far as I remember, immediately as the communist system is collapsing in Albania, there was this immediate ruination of industrial sites and agricultural collective farm sites by people looting, by people stealing, by people destroying. And that was very much which hit the news headlines outside of Albania. And I think it happened much more there than it did in other post-communist Central European countries. It was written in Romania. So it was something quite specific, and for whatever reason, and you refer to it with these bricks in a way as well. So is there any way of quantifying this in relation to the whole sort of problem? And is the attitude of the communities, is it affected because the people took part in this? It wasn't just the collapse of an industry. It wasn't the state working out. It was individual involvement. So did it affect people's attitude to the legacy of post-industrialization? And also, a slightly different question that slightly fits into what was said earlier on by are there also ownership problems? Because obviously these factories were owned by the state, but then there's been so many issues post-1990 of people regaining land or people coming in and taking this land. That must complicate privatization.
it's very interesting how, you know, like from the very beginning when the Western started receiving news from Albania, it would have been negative news. But anyways, like just a parenthesis. So I think what you mentioned in the beginning about like the community's attitude is much, much related to the spirit of the early 90s. Because I believe that the whole narrative and rhetoric of neoliberal democracy influenced as well the attitude that people had with their own labor. So it kind of made redundant factories and manual labor. And instead, it it provided perhaps like this new utopia of growth or of accumulation that might have come not with the actual industrial sites, but rather with connections with the West and the new flows of capital that are coming from abroad. So I think that that is like very much related to like the previous. It was perhaps like a rupture. It was a rupture of how like people themselves understood their labor in that aspect. Your the second part of your question about ownership problems, some of these factories have been privatized. The majority of them are completely abandoned. Like technically, they belong to the state or to local authorities, but in essence, they're completely neglected. And it's also important to mention that the majority of the private factories who operate the remaining facilities, they are foreign companies, which exactly they took advantage of the cheap labor, but also of what it means to transition from one economic system to another. So I think that's also perhaps common to other countries in the region which experienced the transition from one political and economic status quo to another. I don't know if this answers your question.
Okay, I'm happy that we have just a few more minutes so I can ask my question. So one of the things that I started, one of the first things I came across when I started economic basic transition in the Balkans was this idea about the enterprise space, if you want to call it industrial space, and how it was really mismatched with the space as would have been organized in capitalism. So obviously the criteria for, and I mean, you know, you can see probably a lot more than of that in Russia, the Soviet Union, than in the Balkans. Balkans less industrialized, smaller places. But still you can see it. So the criteria under which the allocation of capital, if you want, in across space was done were not based on market efficiency considerations or, you know, export base or whatever. So it was, I mean, in part practicality, of course, but also a lot about distributing population, yeah? And then that's why in some cases, quite a few, you have industrial towns and you know, towns that are built around factories, and you mentioned even Elbasan, I didn't know that, like half of the city was a factory, so to speak, if that's what you mentioned. So, and you mentioned at the beginning, sorry, the notion of like, you know, the first modernity being the industrialization of the communism, and then the ruination being a second modernity. And then, of course, I think the undertone of the presentation was a bit critical or negative about this second modernity. You know, we heard about precarity and unemployment, migration, poverty, exploiting low wages, foreign firms exploiting low wages, and so forth. But in a way, isn't this, I mean, you know, the whole collapse of communism across here, it was a demand for a new or different modernity. And if the modernity, if that different reality, the different modernity, was, at so much at odds with the structurally with the previous one, then you would have to have urination, you would have to have out-migration, you know, some cities becoming much bigger and other places becoming, you know, completely depopulated. I'm thinking not only of Albania, but for Bulgaria is the big issue here, perhaps. So can what I just described be built in this narrative about a legacy and the memory of industrial heritage?
Definitely, that's a very important question, because we shouldn't also forget that those who put down that regime were the people themselves, right? So it kind of reflected this need to open up, to basically also get rid of an oppressive system.
But also to allow an economically dysfunctional system.
It was definitely dysfunctional, exactly because no country is able to survive on its own, and that is where personally I think things went wrong. It's impossible to sustain all that, and also to mention here that during Cold War, the party itself stopped caring about industrialism. Like the new priority was to build the bunkers and all the defensive system against the invisible enemy. So the authority itself, who had put these places in place, they neglected them in the first place. I think that perhaps a critical option, maybe like view here, would be that the new enterprises could have taken better advantage of the resources that were already there, including maybe the expertise or maybe facilities. Maybe keep producing things, but with different regulations. For instance, I think that the matter of pollution here is important. That used to, like, during the communist regime, there was zero concern about pollution, but it seems that the enterprises that are working now, they're not acknowledging anything better, although there is the technology and the science and the expertise to take better measures. So I'm not saying that in terms of like one is good and the other is bad or negative and positive, but perhaps that transition could have happened in different means.
You have to go back to Schumpeter. What you said. Yeah. I mean, I noted this down. I mean, but it is actually a sort of, I think that this is actually makes a point here about, you know, sort of, because whilst Schumpeter talks about destruction, he's got this adjective of created in front of it. And I think that that is something which maybe you could work on. I thought that was very interesting about this. I think, you know,
I tried not to make it explicitly economics.
Well, you would, but then I would as well. So.
Okay, I think we passed the scheduled time. Before asking you to thank the speaker for the usual way, let me thank again the Anglo-Albanian Association for co-organizing this event. Very happy to host you, and I hope we have more events in the future. We'll definitely have more events in Albania, so if you're interested in our events, please consider joining our mailing list or check out our website. Yes, okay. Thank you very much.